Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. It did not take Americans long to figure out that life after September 11th, 2001 would never be quite the same. The attacks have changed the way we travel, the way we think, and the way we view the world. They've also changed what we see at the movies and on TV and what we hear in concert halls and on the radio. This hour, we're looking at post-9/11 America from a popular culture perspective, exploring how September 11th has affected music, TV, and movies. We'll hear from NPR music contributor Tom Moon a little later in the program, but we begin with Virginia Tech theater and cinema professor Stephen Prince, author of Firestorm, American Film in the Age of Terrorism. Welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Very happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to be with us. We want to talk about how the movies have changed since 9/11, how Hollywood has responded over the last 10 years. So, Stephen, let me ask you just to begin with, how did Hollywood do in responding? Did they choose the right stories to tell, for instance?
Well, there was a lot of uncertainty, frankly, I think, about how filmmakers might address 9/11. There was a lot of fear about doing so, and partly that was a matter of committing the high production budgets that films today require. So there was reluctance to take this up. And one reason for that is a sense that, in one way, the events were already so well known, because during the interval when the towers were burning, a tremendous amount of news footage and photographs, video, amateur video was taken, and most moviegoers had been exposed to this, so they had really a kind of searing sense of what the events looked and sounded like. And filmmakers really paused before undertaking the construction of stories that might represent these events to a movie-going audience.
And there certainly was that concern about profiting from this tragedy and using it as a form of entertainment, particularly in the time shortly thereafter when everyone was shell-shocked. At what point, then, did Hollywood decide it's okay to move ahead with this? This is a story that we need to tell. It's something we need to revisit.
Well, it took a few years, but there were some very enterprising filmmakers who moved quickly to take it up. Spike Lee, for example, did a picture called 25th Hour, which was a movie not about 9/11, but it's about a drug dealer going off to prison. But Lee created the whole subtext of the film is about being in Manhattan in the immediate aftermath of the attack. So you had films like that kind of obliquely dealt with what had happened. And then it was really a few years before pictures like World Trade Center and United 93 were produced.
Yeah, and we want to talk about those in a little bit greater detail. In fact, we have a few clips that we'll get to momentarily. I'm wondering, Stephen, did Hollywood find a new villain in the process of this? You know, you think back to World War II, and, you know, Nazis were the villains back then, the Soviets. There were all kinds of, you know, different villains sort of that were portrayed in the movies. Did Hollywood find a new one post-9/11?
Well, that's a good question. I think actually Hollywood had to get rid of some of its old villains because prior to 9/11, movies about terrorism gave us madmen, right? Characters who really didn't need to be motivated. They just had to be irrational and were interested in blowing up buildings. And after 9/11, when it became clearer and clearer that bin Laden had particular reasons for doing what he did that he found compelling, the notion of completely irrational terrorists that we had been seeing in generations of movies really no longer seemed quite to fly, because now there was a very specific enemy who was religiously motivated and had a list of political grievances. So, you know, the old crackpot terrorists that moviegoers had seen so often, in a way, were irrelevant to what the new perceived threat had come to be. So Hollywood had to kind of retool and find a way of dealing with terrorism in a way that was not quite so invested in fantasy.
And yet, Stephen, you, in times past, you had an enemy who typically wore a certain kind of uniform, was very easy to spot. Not so much anymore when we think about modern-day terrorism.
Yeah, that was the really unsettling thing, that you're riding on an airplane and the fellow sitting next to you might suddenly try to light a bomb fuse in his shoe. How do you defend against that? I mean, the climate of fear that gripped the country in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 was I think rooted in that sense that people who aren't wearing uniforms but who are blending in nevertheless wish you did.
Yeah, and do you think that as well as some of the movies that you just mentioned have given rise to sort of a culture of anxiety since 9/11?
Yes, it definitely has, and we also have to remember the anthrax attacks right after 9/11, which really helped ratchet up the anxiety level. Now that we've gone, almost 10 years without another large-scale attack, I think that the anxiety is still there, but it's coupled with a kind of curious sense of apathy, right? A sense that, well, it hasn't happened, it's not going to happen. So it's a real, almost contradictory sort of mindset, I think, that the culture now is living within.
Stephen, we have a couple of movie clips we want to get to in the time that we have with you, and I want to start off with one from United 93. We'd like to play that clip and then have you talk with us a little bit about it, if we could.
Cleveland just called. There's a United 93. The controller heard screams coming from the cockpit.
This is starting to look like a pattern.
Where is that aircraft last known? You know, which way is he heading? We got to get track information.
He was a Newark to San Francisco flight.
All right.
Still on board.
Get all the adjacent centers. Notify them in every direction. Keep me advised on flight 93.
Hey, Ben.
Delta's fine. He's not a hijacker.
Delta's not. Good.
Take him off the board. Delta 1989.
You know what? You're too hot, bro.
Yes. Yes, sir. Four planes. That's all I've got. I can't defend the whole eastern seaboard with four planes.
What do you got?
Washington's on the phone. They said they've got American 77 lost. They just went missing out of Dulles. He's supposed to go to LAX.
This is another one?
What did she say?
77 coming out of Dulles. It's heading west, going to LAX. Light me up every track, guys. What do you got?
I don't know how many more there could be in the air, sir, but the point is this. We've got to get them before they're within range of Washington. We've got to get them before they're 60 miles, 50 miles minimum, or we're not going to have a play. We're not going to be able to protect the Capitol.
And again, Stephen, United 93, a lot of mayhem going on in that scene.
Yes, and that scene that you played really is a good choice because the dialogue about American 77, that scene captures the level of confusion that was underway that morning. And this is really important to remember because one of the deceptive things that a lot of film and television programming have offered viewers is the idea that the security forces had events well in hand and that the government was then and now kind of one step ahead of the terrorists. What United 93 shows is the almost complete breakdown of security and communications infrastructure,
yeah.
Because events were happening too fast, and they were happening in ways that no one had planned for, right? I mean, airline hijackings always ended with the plane landing somewhere and negotiations over what the hijackers' demands were.
Yeah.
The idea that planes wouldn't land and that they would, in fact, be used as bombs was not something that people thought about prior to 9/11. So that film really shows, I think, quite powerfully this process of breakdown and, desperate efforts to keep pace with events that were unfolding much too quickly.
Stephen, I want to contrast that with the film World Trade Center and in this particular scene that we're about to play, the building collapses over the rescue team from the Port Authority Police Department. Let's listen to this clip and then tell us what you think.
For their live coverage.
Here at the top of this tower, there's a huge gaping hole, flames still inside.
Can you believe this? What schmuck could fly a plane into the Trade Center?
Maybe they ran out of gas or something.
Yeah, Colavito, right.
That's not a small plane.
Hell no.
All right, listen up! Let me have your attention here.
They're telling us it's a commuter plane. Tower 1's being evacuated as a precaution. They've asked us to send a team down to assist. Sergeant McLaughlin.
I've got a list of names here. Step out when you hear it. We're going downtown. Polnicki.
Sarge.
Colavito.
Sarge.
Washington.
Sarge.
O'Reilly.
Sarge.
Jimeno.
Sarge.
Hogard.
Sarge.
Babley.
Sarge.
Rodriguez.
Sarge.
Giraldi.
Sarge.
Pizzullo.
Sarge.
Stolzman.
Different feel there, Stephen. Tell us, contrast that with United 93.
Well, it's a matter of point of view. Both of these movies are very fact-based, and the filmmakers, Paul Greengrass in the case of United 93 and Oliver Stone in the case of World Trade Center, really wanted to stick close to the factual record. In the case of United 93, we get an overview of what's happening because we're often in the air traffic control centers. In the case of World Trade Center, the point of view there is more restricted because it's what McLaughlin and Jimeno, the Port Authority officers who were trapped under the tower when it collapsed, what they experienced for the most part. So that means that in that movie, a lot of what happened is off stage. It's off screen. We don't really spend much time with the attacks themselves. Most of the movie were trapped, below ground with the officers.
And then, Stephen, we see not only movies about the actual day, 9/11, but then, of course, we started seeing films dealing with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We saw, fictional films that were created. Do you think that that was an easier task for filmmakers, that type of film post 9/11?
Well, judging by the number of productions, I would say yes. World Trade Center and United 93 are the only major Hollywood films to deal directly with the attacks on 9/11. By contrast, there are a lot of movies that have been made about the Iraq War, and I think perhaps that suggests that the Iraq War was more distant and less disturbing for audiences than 9/11, and certainly in part, that's because on 9/11, it was civilians who were being killed by the thousands. And in a war zone, you have soldiers in combat, and that's a more kind of thinkable scenario. It's more unthinkable to contemplate the sudden deaths of thousands of civilians.
Yeah, we're a lot more used to watching war movies, to watching the violence that we expect to take place,
genre,
right?
And so. Yeah, viewers are familiar with that.
Yeah. We have much more to talk about when we come back from our break. We also want to talk about television, and 24 comes to mind, certainly. Anyone who thinks about television post 9/11, a couple of other movies that we'd like you to give us your thoughts on about as well. We are talking about how pop culture has changed in the years since 9/11, how filmmakers and musicians responded, and we'll be back with more when Radio Times comes back.
The 26th Annual Mushroom Festival supports WHYY, Friday, September 9th through Sunday, September 11th in Kennett Square, minutes from Longwood Gardens. Featuring cooking demonstrations by Philadelphia restaurateur and Food Network Iron Chef Jose Garces and Bravo TV's Top Chef DC, Kevin Spraga. Other festival highlights include a range of mushroom delicacies, more than 180 vendors, an antique and classic car show, and live music. More online at mushroomfestival.org.
On September 11th, an NPR News special, coverage of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for memorial services from Ground Zero, the Pentagon, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We'll also report on how the day is being remembered around the country. That's special coverage from NPR News, the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Sunday morning, starting at 8 on WHYY.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine, weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow Newsworks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about the 10th anniversary of 9/11, but specifically we're talking about how 9/11 has changed pop culture. How has Hollywood responded to the events of that day? How have musicians responded as well? We have been talking with Virginia Tech Theater and Cinema Professor Stephen Prince, who was the author of Firestorm, American Film in the Age of Terrorism. We're going to be talking with Tom Moon as well, NPR music contributor, in just a few minutes about how 9/11 impacted music. But Stephen, we want to get back to the movies. We were talking about some of the war movies when we left off, and you can't talk about war movies without talking about The Hurt Locker, a recent one, a big hit. A lot of people had a lot to say about that movie.
Yes, that was, in some ways, that was the critical breakthrough movie for those that dealt with the Iraq War. It was a reasonable-sized hit, largely because of the Academy Award win that brought a lot more viewers to it. Like a lot of the Iraq War movies, however, it really avoids politics. Most of the movies that are about the war itself take a sort of ground level view, an up close view of what what the experience is like, and in this case, of course, it's the nerve wracking work of defusing bombs.
Well, speaking of nerve-wracking, we have a clip from Hurt Locker that we want to play. It's a scene where the elite Army bomb squad is trying to detonate explosives planted on an Iraqi man. Here it is.
Sanborn, I got the suit. Just go. Sanborn, you have 45 seconds. You have 45 seconds, Sanborn.
Damn, man, Will.
Go!
Everybody get back!
Go!
Hold on!
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let go of me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Get down now.
Stephen, that makes your heart race just hearing it.
Yeah, it sure does. Indeed, it does. I think one of the things that a movie like The Hurt Locker points to is the extremely high casualty rate in the Iraq War, in terms of grievously wounded American soldiers.
Yeah. Let's talk about Rendition as well, 2007 movie starring Reese Witherspoon, Jake Gyllenhaal. Raised some questions about U.S. policy on torture, and we have a scene here where a CIA analyst, that's Gyllenhaal, questions his assignment after witnessing an unorthodox interrogation at a secret detention facility outside the U.S. I want you to listen to it and then comment on it.
If you don't have the stomach for this, then you should ask to be reassigned. Douglas, I can't help you.
We have a saying, too. Do you know Shakespeare?
Of course, I know Shakespeare.
I fear you speak upon the rack, where men enforced do speak anything. Saeed, in all the years you've been doing this, how often can you say that we've produced truly legitimate intelligence? Once? Twice? 10 times? Just give me a statistic. Give me a number. Give me a pie chart. I love pie charts. Anything. Anything that outweighs the fact that if you torture one person, you create 10, 100, 1,000 new enemies.
Stephen, what do you say?
Well, 9/11 produced a lot of kind of fallout in terms of things the movies have addressed. The Iraq War is one thing, and the efforts by the Bush administration to evade the laws on torture is another issue that quite a few movies and television shows have addressed. And the question, of course, that was debated is whether torture gets results. Are people likely to give up information if you brutalize them? That was very controversial issue for years following 9/11. And Rendition is based on some real events and takes the position that it's more effective not to torture to rely on conventional intelligence measures.
And it seems, Stephen, that filmmakers really sort of followed the perspective of the American public. You know, in shortly after 9/11, of course, there was just the sadness, the outrage, and all of those emotions. And then, as we got into these wars, a sense of skepticism about, you know, why are we here? Are we doing the right thing? How do we know when this is over? And it seemed that the movies reflected that as well, and certainly the questions about torture, which you just talked about.
Yes, and few, you know, few things were more damaging to the U.S. effort overseas than the events of Abu Ghraib and the photographs that came out from that. And, you know, interviews with Army snipers indicated that they, after those photos came out, they expected an increase of violence in their sectors because of the anger that it generated.
Yeah. Well, we can't talk about film, about television, without talking about 24. Certainly that has been a huge hit on television. Talk about that as an expression of television's responding to 9/11.
Well, television, in some ways, responded more extensively. There were more references and depictions of 9/11 events on television, both in terms of movies and series. And I think what that suggests is that perhaps viewers felt more comfortable contemplating these things inside their homes than they did. Hello.
Here we are.
Than they did leaving their homes to go out to the theater and share a public space with other people.
Hmm. So was there something safer, something maybe more comforting about watching it in your family room or your basement as opposed to on the big screen, do you think?
I think that's quite possibly so, yeah. And 24, for a time, really capitalized on the desire for payback. You had Kiefer Sutherland going around doing all kind of really crazy things as the hero of the show. And of course, his character is a real believer in torture. He knows that it's the best way to get reliable information.
Hmm. Stephen, as we wrap up our conversation, as we look ahead, what do you think we ought to be looking for? Will we see more of this as we're getting farther away from September 11th, 2001? Do you think that musicians and filmmakers will continue to respond, to create works of art that in some way reflect either back to 9/11 or to the wars that have followed?
Well, certainly they will. The country and the culture is different today because of 9/11, and film will continue to respond to that. I think as the events get more distant, some of the urgency goes away, but then, too, perhaps perspectives can become more clear and less guided by emotion. Hmm. I would also say that viewers wanting to check out important films about 9/11 should also look to documentaries. A tremendous number of very fine documentaries have been made about 9/11.
Well, Stephen Prince, thank you so much for taking time to help us explore some of the films and television shows, for that matter, that have been created since 9/11 and helping us to get a better perspective on how filmmaking and television has changed in the years since. Stephen is author of Firestorm, American Film in the Age of Terrorism, and he is from Virginia Tech, where he's a theater and cinema professor. Stephen, thanks again for being
with
us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, we're not only talking about film and how film and television have changed in the years since 9/11, but we want to talk about music as well, because certainly 9/11 has had a great influence on the music that has been produced over the last 10 years, and we thought there would be no one better to talk to about how music has changed in those years than Tom Moon. And if that name rings a bell, it certainly should. You've probably read much of his material when he was writing for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He is also an NPR music contributor and just a guy who knows a whole heck of a lot about music. He has written 1,000 recordings to hear before you die. Chances are you know about that. It's a New York Times bestseller. Tom Moon joins us now on Radio Times. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So, Tom, let's just talk generally. How has music changed in the last 10 years?
Well, as Stephen said, the whole culture has changed, and certainly part of what we see in music is the immediate reaction stuff where people are essentially people like Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young are trying to grapple with grief and what it means for a nation that has enjoyed so much placidity in its cultural life to suddenly be thrown in upheaval and actually become, you know, find itself in the crosshairs. But then what's interesting as time has gone on, the perspective does deepen and you start to see some composers, and actually classical music is in some ways better equipped for this because it's more abstract and allows for sort of a deeper level of reflection than maybe a three-minute pop song does. And what you start to see is artists and composers writing things that address the tragedy on, or the sets of tragedy, on an emotional level, on a sort of a broader what it means to grieve almost kind of level.
Well, speaking of classical music, we actually have a selection, a portion of a selection that we'd like to play. This is Stephen Reich's piece, World Trade Center, WTC 9/11. It was commissioned for and recorded by Kronos Quartet, and a very, very intense piece of music. We're going to play a little bit of it, and then, Tom, I'd like you to comment on it and give us some perspective. Here it is.
They came from Boston on an airline, and I heard it sound. You're on the run. You're on the run. What?
And that was Stephen Reich's WTC 9/11. Tom, what do you think about that?
Well, it's an amazing piece. It's very much builds on what Reich has done in the past with pattern pulse and sort of static rhythmic cells that repeat over and over, which, of course, is part of what happens with 9/11 is as the events of that morning unfolded, it became almost like a ticker tape kind of percussive thing. Every few minutes, something else was happening. I think he's really captured with the sort of the music of this piece that sense of destabilization, that the things are coming at us we don't understand. And then on top of that, there are these voices, and some of the voices are taken from the NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command, air traffic controllers, who are the military traffic controllers who are following the progress of these errant planes. And so he slowed down the voices in that excerpt we heard, but in some places they're more gripping, and it almost sounds like the excerpt we heard from the Hurt Locker, where the people are started. The urgency of the moment is starting to dawn on people who are just sitting essentially at a computer.
And it's not classical music in the sense that we might traditionally think about classical music, in that you've got, you know, these actual recordings of air traffic controllers, and you've got all this other audio mixed in.
That's right. And he's actually written this for three different string quartets, so there's some overlap with different string textures that are used in very specific ways. So sometimes you'll feel a much larger group, and sometimes things will thin out, and there'll be more of a pointillistic, very very sparse setting.
Yeah. Is there a point, Tom, at which that type of music can become exploitative because it does use some of the actual recordings? Or do you think it just adds to that sense of being overwhelmed of the outrage, the fear, the terror of that day?
Boy, is that a great question, because, of course, immediately after 9/11, we started to see people using the images in YouTube videos, and we started to see, you know, people writing these very emotional songs that were sort of amateur-produced songs that they would use the footage. And that's sort of the same situation, isn't it? Because, you know, those images are deep with us, and they sort of have meaning beyond even the destruction of a building. And so it can very easily be considered, if not exploitative, at least manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that same charge came at some of the pop people. I mean, I was among the minority of folks who didn't really love Bruce Springsteen's The Rising. I felt some of that was, while very heartfelt, and I was not challenging his right to do it or anything, I kept coming back to this idea that, is this great art, or is this a songwriting exercise in order to sort of work through this massive sort of formless grief, which is very different from the loss of, one loved one or an event like that that might trigger a song.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit of that since you brought it up. Let's hear My City of Ruins. This is Bruce Springsteen, post 9/11.
A blood red circle on the cold dark ground, and the rain is falling down. The church door slowed open, I can hear the organ song, and the congregation's gone. My city of ruins, my city of ruin. Now the sweet bells of mercy drip through the evening trees, young men on the corner like scattered leaves. The boarded up windows, the empty streets, are my brothers down.
The Boss, of course, Bruce Springsteen, singing My City of Ruins. Tom Moon, you said that you were initially not necessarily on board with this. Do you think, was it cathartic? Did it help people, a song like this?
Sure. And some other stuff on the rising, particularly the title song, which was talking about, this idea of prevailing and sort of soldiering on in the face of this adversity, was incredibly stirring. And I think a lot of people, when Springsteen performs this on the benefit concerts and stuff, it is moving. It's beautiful. I mean, what's interesting about that song is he said initially that it was written, most of that record was written directly in response to 9/11. My City of Ruins actually predates it, and he's talking initially about Asbury Park and his city, and looking at the economic devastation there, and obviously not necessarily a parallel, but very interesting that someone can be moved in one direction, sketching this bleak scenario, and it is completely applicable to another.
Yeah. Was some of the appeal of that album just Springsteen himself? He's the boss. He's the born in the USA guy. Just his sort of all-American kind of appeal?
Sure. And the fact that at that time he was gathering back the E Street Band, he was in this position of sort of revving up again, writing, aiming to write big, culturally relevant songs again after having spent a few years writing smaller things. And, on that level, it totally worked. As I said, some of the individual tracks on that record now, there's a song called You're Missing. And it really is the kind of thing that you would have that would have struck a chord right then, because we knew so many people that were in. The footage on the news was all pointed at that kind of thing, and yet now we don't. It doesn't ring the same way.
We're talking with Tom Moon about how music has changed in the years since 9/11. How have artists responded? We're taking a look at pop culture when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKS, a luxury sedan featuring available Active Park Assist technology. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
On the next Fresh Air, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs a couple of songs in tribute to the men and women who have served since 9/11. And NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel tells behind-the-scenes stories about his recent reporting from Libya, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What do progressive Democrats think of President Obama's blueprint to get people back to work? We'll hear from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Also, a 9/11 diary from Rhett Miller of the old 97s. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, featuring hand-knotted rugs made by fairly paid adults. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com. 10,000 Villages. Quality you desire. Fairness artisans deserve.
You're listening to Radio Times, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. As we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11, certainly there has been much coverage of it in the news. We are taking a look at how it changed pop culture, specifically film and music, and in this portion of the program, music. We're talking about how musicians have responded on all levels, classical music, rock and roll, and all things in between. We're talking with Tom Moon. You remember him from his work at the Philadelphia Inquirer as a music critic there. He is also a music contributor for NPR. And Tom, when we left off, we were talking about Springsteen, but certainly he was not the only one who had a response to 9/11. When we think about the whole rock and roll genre of music, there were many others as well.
Yeah, one of the great first great songs that came out of it, I think, was Neil Young's Let's Roll, which takes its inspiration from Flight 93 and those heroic passengers on that flight who galvanized by a guy named Todd, I think his name's Beeson, Todd Beamer, mm-hmm. who is speaking via phone with someone on the ground and finally galvanizes several of his other passengers. And the last audio they hear on the ground is him saying, "Let's roll." And Neil took that idea and just ran with it. And that's an example of some very small thing, just a phrase, where it had enough resonance in the world. It was part of the coverage. We all understood what he meant when he said that. And it became a sort of more symbolic point.
Yeah, almost a rallying cry in some sense.
And, you know, so you have that kind of thing. And then you have the very predictable American, we're going to go womp some people kind of response from Toby Keith, his song Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, which was really, you know, sort of a knee-jerk, very almost predictable response of, you know, you're going to mess with us, get ready, because the wrath of America is coming.
We're coming
kind of
back
thing.
At you. Yeah. Certainly there were other pieces as well that came out during that time. Steve Earle, we got to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, that record is, he has a record that came out in 2002 called Jerusalem, and it has a couple of songs that were very closely identified with 9/11. The one that got the most press is this song called, I've lost the title. John Walker's Blues, mm-hmm. and it's talking about the young American man, John Walker Lind, who was found in Afghanistan and was called the American Taliban. And he's very sympathetic to Lind, and he's not making the judgment that someone like Toby Keith would make, which is, you know, you traitor. And he sort of sets up this idea that even in these moments of being America being victimized and terrorism sort of ratcheting up to this extreme level, that the values of America and the idea that, there are differences of opinion and let's not rush to condemn. And I think it was important for someone in popular music to say that, and I think he did a beautiful job.
Yeah, well, let's hear a little bit of that, and we'll talk about it some more. Here it is.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim, and the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shall know, I lie, there's no God.
if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet, he don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes, and I believe God is great. All praise due to him. And if I should die, I rise up to the sky just like Jesus, peace be upon him. I shall do la ila ha ila la. There's no God but God.
And you're listening to Steve Earle, John Walker's Blues, and Tom Moon, as you pointed out, a little different take on 9/11.
Yeah, what I really love about that is the way he's singing. Many of us, or many artists, at the point right after 9/11, there was a lot of fervence in the work. There was a lot of, like, we know what we're doing. Again, the Toby Keith song, you know, like a degree of conviction that I think was important and needed. And here, a year later, Steve Earle sort of having some doubts, and, you know, his voice is trembling, and he's not necessarily so confident about what he believes or what his character believes. Yeah. And it's very interesting. His writing has a lot of there's a lot of wisdom in that whole record. There's a line on another song called Ashes to Ashes where he says, "Every tower ever built tumbles." It's, you know, it's best to keep that in mind. And yeah, that idea of impermanence, you know, one thing about an event that's such a huge event like this is there's the immediate stuff, and then there's all the stuff that where you're really dealing with the larger issues, things like what are we here for? Are the things that we expect to sort of live forever, or will they live forever? Are these towers really indestructible, any tower? And that kind of stuff, there's a lot of work that comes after 9/11 that doesn't have any relationship to 9/11 in terms of what it's talking about, but was sort of triggered by or inspired in some way by this idea that, yeah, oh man, we may not have much time, we better get busy.
You know, Tom, you mentioned Neil Young earlier and just sort of the reference to that particular day, and I'm thinking about the things that have happened in the years since the Navy SEALs took out Osama bin Laden. Mm. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary, so there's a lot more television coverage. We're seeing those images of the towers falling and bringing back all of those memories. I want us to hear a little bit of that Neil Young song, and then to talk about whether a song like that takes on perhaps a new significance 10 years later, but let's hear a little bit of Neil Young.
I know I said I love you. I know you know it's true. I got to put the phone down and do what we gotta do. One standing in the highway, two more at the door. We got to get inside.
Neil Young with Let's Roll. And Tom, you talked about the significance of that song. Everyone remembers the story of Todd Beamer and how Let's Roll became almost a rallying cry, a slogan for a time. Does a song like that, in light of the emotions that have come up 10 years later, take on a renewed significance, do you think?
Well, when I'm listening to it now, I'm thinking that it serves us as history. And there will be a time soon when children will not have lived through this. And they may be curious about what happened and how individual, ordinary citizens reacted. And songs like this are going to be part of that document that tells us, you know, what was this like on that day. And I think beyond that, someone, an artist who's sort of portraying a cluster of very tangled, conflicted emotions, as all these artists that we're talking about were. They were all sort of sorting out their own responses to this as they're writing. I think that their work, even when it's a songwriting exercise, even when it's something like I was making the point about You're Missing, it has use for us and value in, like, what were people thinking about on the days following the attacks?
I want to invite our listeners to join us in case you've got a question about how music has changed since 9/11 and how our music has reflected the events of that day and the things that have happened since. The number is 888-477-9499. But, Tom, you mentioned children, and there was a recording that I heard, and I believe it was on NPR's website, don't remember who put it together, but it had snatches of sound bites from children. The person who recorded it took recordings of his child's preschool. Wow. The day of 9/11, they were in New York. He actually saw one of the planes hit one of the towers and later on interviewed some of these children about what happened that day and what their perspective was, and saved those recordings for a long time, trying to figure out what to do with them, and ended up mixing them into some music and sort of, you know, stretching out the voices and doing some audio tricks.
Yeah.
What do you think about something like that?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a little bit different than a documentary project where someone who's of age is being interviewed about an event. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, again, all artistic responses to something like this can be considered valid. I mean, you know, this idea of wanting to capture what a preschooler maybe felt in that moment, especially being in New York. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I know that the children who were with President Bush that day have been interviewed since. And, you know, that's of value, too. I mean, basically, this is one of those historical record moments where any and all little stray little bits of information become part of it. And whether someone takes a phrase like let's roll and makes a song of it, or someone like the gentleman you mentioned who's just capturing audio and then weaves it together as a collage, I mean, I guess there's a use for that.
Yeah, in a time capsule sort of way,
that's
if
right.
Nothing else,
yeah.
Right? Want to squeeze in a quick call if we can. We'll go to Hopewell, New Jersey, and bring Aaron in to Radio Times. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Your comment or question for Tom.
Yeah, you know, I just heard that few seconds worth of Let's Roll, and it really struck me. I mean, it got me chills when I was driving my car because it resonates as kind of a spirit, but it also is just a remembrance. It really kind of embodies all the things that you guys are talking about. But for me, that one particular song is the time capsule.
Hmm. Well, thanks, Aaron, for your call. Tom?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's such a small little thing. I mean, it's really just those two words, let's roll. And yet, it does seem to capture, in a way, it brings back, I mean, it does what all great art does, which is bring us to a place that we either didn't expect to be taken or were at one time and are revisiting now.
Yeah. Tom, were there other genres of music that reflected 9/11? I'm thinking about jazz, about R&B. I mean, we talked about rock and roll. We talked about classic. Were there others?
Yeah. More in country. R&B and jazz is an interesting case because I think that there were, obviously, as we all were affected, jazz musicians were affected by this. I don't remember hearing a lot of work that was aiming itself directly at 9/11. I mean, I'm sure that Wynton Marsalis had some involvement in concerts that benefit concerts that followed and things like that. But there it wasn't the same sort of I'm going to write a song about this impulse. And that's, you know, that's interesting because in pop we sort of now expect people to do that. In hip hop, the Beastie Boys had a great. The Beastie Boys are from New York. Had a great kind of New York rallying song, and it's called Open Letter to NYC, and I thought that was a really powerful moment, and a song more geared to New Yorkers and the events of that day there.
Tom, in the last couple of minutes before we close, we want to leave some time to talk about a particular piece that has really resonated with many people, and it's called On the Transmigration of Souls. Tell us about that piece and why it's so powerful.
Well, it was commissioned by the New York Philharmonic to honor the victims. It was written by John Adams, who is one of, I think, the most inventive composers working today. He's just a wonderful mix of very rhythmic work. He understands the rhythms of popular music, but then he's got this melodic sense that seems to unfold over time. You don't get hit with his melodies all at once. They just sort of seep around and kind of envelop you. And that's what this piece does. He called it, at the time when it was premiered, he called it a memory space where, quote, you can be alone with your thoughts and emotions. And that's part of the function of music too, isn't it? This idea of not just recalling what we all lived through that day, but also giving us some space to wrestle with what this stuff means and the implications of this day. Obviously, the fact that we're talking about this now, yeah. There's still a lot to wrestle with. And one thing that music does better than anything else is sort of provide a space for us to engage that and think about the monumental things in our lives, whether it's adversity or tragedy like this or whatever. And John Adams really captures that with this.
Yeah, we're going to play it in about 30 seconds, but I just wanted to point out there are choirs too, and this is that's not right. Strictly instrumental.
No, that's right. And there's all kinds of different use of voices here. There's the actual text, but there's also the sort of washes of vocal harmony that are very interesting.
Well, we are going to leave you today with composer John Adams and the piece called On the Transmigration of Souls. As Tom just said, Adams called it a memory space where you can be alone with your thoughts and emotions. Here's composer John Adams on the Transmigration of Souls. You were listening to On the Transmigration of Souls by composer John Adams, featuring Lauren Mazel conducting the new